We are at lecture 12, and in our strategy we arrived over here. We will eventually at the end of the course do the path integral quantization, but today, because it is more useful in cosmology, we will do the canonical quantization after a Legendre transform. So remember the general relativistically covariant Klein-Gordon equation. This is the expression for the Klein-Gordon equation, and notice that I dropped the potential now to keep things a little simpler. This Klein-Gordon equation arose from, just to remind you, from setting the derivative of the action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field equal to zero. So this is the classical field equation. And we call that equation Kg for Klein-Gordon. Here was the action again. Now look at the action closely. Can you read off what the Lagrangian is from that action? Do you remember how we went from the Lagrangian to the action? We went from the Lagrangian to the action by performing a time integral. We needed that time integral so that we can then do the functional differentiation for space and time and all of that. I hope you remember this. In any case, so here's the action, Klein-Gordon action, and the Lagrangian was obtained by doing a time integral. Of course, that was still when we were doing special relativity. Now we have general relativity. In any case, the Lagrangian is obtained by a time integration. So we can read off what the Lagrangian of this action is. It's this, where the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian is the integral over just space, and then the whole thing here, and the measure everything, but we're not integrating over time, just integrating over space. So the time integral of that gives us the Klein-Gordon action. If you really like covariance, you're not liking that step, right? Because singles out time. So you see how we step into that not obviously covariant territory. Now, the Legendre transform will get us to the Hamiltonian formulation now. And keep in mind that we proved about the Legendre transform that it is an invertible map. And we were Legendre transforming. The equations of motion of one side were translating into the equations of motion of the other side. And this will be just a particular special case of what we did earlier, more generally. So here's now the third step, where we go in this bigger program here, step three, this way, right? That's what I indicated as step three. Here we go. The Legendre transform. We take the Lagrangian, which depends in our reading of things for the purpose of the Legendre transform. It depends on phi, and it depends on the time derivative of phi. Right? This is how the Lagrangian operates. It depends on a variable and its time derivative. Sure, it technically also depends on the space derivatives, but the space derivatives of phi are just derivatives of phi. So in that sense, it's just a phi dependence. What we distinguish here for the purpose of the Legendre transform is only phi and its space derivatives on one side, and the time derivatives of phi, the occurrences of the time derivative of phi. So we are viewing the Lagrangian here as being a functional of phi that includes its space derivatives, and specifically also the time derivative of phi. Remember, comma zero means d by dx zero. So it's the time derivative. And then it depends on time too, because this thing is no longer integrated over time, so it explicitly depends on time. All right, so here's the Lagrangian, and we want to do the Legendre transform with respect to this variable here, as usual. Now in the other direction from what we did earlier, now we go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian. So what is the canonically conjugate variable to phi dot? Well, it's what we call the pi. pi is, and this is how the Legendre transform operates, dl by phi dot. Once we perform that Legendre transform, we will arrive at the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian will depend on time, of course. It will depend on phi and the space derivatives of phi. And it will depend on pi. So once we define pi, the pi field, we will actually have to invert that relationship so that we can then express phi dot in terms of pi. So that on this side, we have no longer any phi dot occurrences. All occurrences of phi dot will be replaced by pi, or by the proper expression of phi dot in terms of pi. So explicitly, it's this. We take that Lagrangian and differentiate it with respect to the time derivative. And that is what we call pi. dl by d phi, comma, 0. What is it? Where do we have the time derivative occurring in here? Well, we have the time derivative in here. You see that mu runs from 0 to 3. And in particular, there's this occurrence of mu equals 0 here, and as well over there. No time derivative here. So when we differentiate the Lagrangian functionally with respect to phi dot, which is to say with phi comma 0, we get two contributions that are the same. Once when we differentiate this, once when we differentiate that with respect to phi comma 0. And what we get is, because we get it twice, the 1/2 factor goes away. And we still have this square root of g here. So differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to phi gives us a square root of g from here. And then we get a g mu 0, or 0 mu. The two terms give us the same thing. Let's carry it forward over here. And then the other phi comma mu, right? So if this thing hits 0, we can still sum over all the nus over there, and vice versa. So that's the answer we have been looking for quite a while. What is the canonically conjugate momentum field for phi? It is this. On Minkowski space, choosing Cartesian coordinates of an inertial observer, we should get back phi dot. Do we? Yes, we do. Because Minkowski space, in a Cartesian coordinate system, g is just, this thing is 1. That is the eta 0 mu. And although we sum over mu, we only have one contribution because the eta is diagonal. We only will have a contribution eta 0, 0. Only that thing will contribute. 0i components of eta are always vanishing. So ultimately, this is just, well, phi comma 0, which is the time derivative of phi. But we now notice that the canonically conjugate momentum field really depends on more. There's this dependence here, and what's more, it actually depends not only on the time derivative, but also on space derivatives in general. If the metric tensor is not diagonal, then pi will also depend on space derivatives, on top of depending on time derivatives. Let us spell this out. We have that the field pi is given by square root of g, and then we have the usual type of thing, namely a time derivative. It's just a little bit decorated, but it's basically the time derivative, plus this dependence on the space derivative. So if it's simply written out what that sum is, sum from 0 to 3, that's the 0 term, and these are the 3 space terms. And you see that in this case, we can actually perform the Legendre transform completely, because this equation that expresses pi in terms of phi and phi dot can be inverted to give us phi dot in terms of pi and phi, which is something that is necessary for the Legendre transform. We need to be able to replace the occurrences of phi dot in the Hamiltonian so that the Hamiltonian only depends on phi and pi. Can do. Namely, phi dot is, because of that equation, simply pi over g naught naught times the square root of g minus this stuff. A little ugly, but that's what it is. So now the Hamiltonian follows from the rules of Legendre transform. Remember the rules of the Legendre transform. We sum over the new variables times the old variables. Summing over means integrating when we have a continuum of them. So new variables times old variables minus the old function, the Lagrangian. So this is the Lagrangian. And here we have sum over new variables times old variables. Remember that h is supposed to depend only on phi and pi. Therefore, here, all occurrences of phi dot, namely here and in this, need to be replaced by that, which depends only on pi and the space derivatives of phi. A little comment. Here we have this integral, and it doesn't have a square root of g in it. Now, we know that covariance is not obvious in this formalism, but just a note. There really is a square root of g in this business, because pi has a square root of g in it. See, pi is square root of g times other stuff. So really, there is a factor of square root of g in this. Okay, so we said already that we need to replace all occurrences of phi dot by the appropriate expression of phi dot in terms of phi and pi. And I leave it to you as an exercise to actually carry that out so that you have h in terms of phi and pi, and then simplify as far as possible. So then what are the equations of motion? We know from the general properties of the Legendre transform that, well, but they have to be, namely, that the time derivative of phi has to be dh by d pi. Time derivative of pi has to be minus dh by d phi, just because that's always how the equations of motion come out under the Legendre transform from a Lagrangian. And again, it's a little exercise to check that this is really what you get from the Klein-Gordon equation, or that this gives you the Klein-Gordon equation. All right, so that was relatively quick. So now we are over here. The Hamiltonian formalism. Still we haven't second quantized. This is just classical fields, classical Klein-Gordon fields in the Hamiltonian formalism. Next thing what we want to do is to quantize that. So what exactly do we need to solve in order to quantize the theory? Well, we want a quantum theory. So we want that the canonical commutation relations hold. Now we know what the objects are that have to obey the canonical quantization rules, namely phi and pi, and we now know what pi is. So the commutator between phi and pi at equal time has to be this. The phis commute with each other and the pis commute with each other at equal time. Notice, by the way, that at non-equal time, they don't necessarily have to commute. It's only at equal time that they have to commute. Intuitively, you can imagine this way. This here is independent of that here. And however, if you wait for a long time, waves can have traveled from that event to this one and affect that. So you can have that they don't commute. So these conditions, these quantization conditions, are the canonical commutation relations, and therefore we use the acronym CCRs. Also, on top of having to solve these equations, and just a sec, what does it mean that we have to solve those equations? It means that we need to find operator-valued functions of space and time which obey this in terms of operators on some Hilbert spaces. In practice, of course, we will express the phi and the pi in terms of A and A daggers, which obey certain commutation relations. But ultimately, the goal is to just find some mathematical objects, concrete ones, that will obey these commutation relations. And we will do it indirectly by expressing those guys in terms of A and A dagger operators. And the A and A dagger operators we can write down explicitly as matrices. because we know already how to represent the A and A dagger operators as concrete matrices on concrete column vectors and as raising and lowering operators. Okay, so on top of needing to solve these equations, we also need to make sure that these operator valued or matrix valued functions of space and time are self-adjoint because they stem from a real valued field. And we want the same for the canonically conjugate momentum fields. Let's call these conditions HC for Hermitian conjugate or hermeticity condition. Means that all the field expectation values ought to be real. And finally, we also need to solve the equations of motion. In the Heisenberg picture, which we will always use here, the equations of motion are formally unchanged. As always in quantization, if F is some observable, the time derivative of that observable is given by the commutator of F with the Hamiltonian. And we can plug in for F, for example, the field itself. We can plug in for F, for example, the canonically conjugate momentum field, work out what the commutator is. And what we will find when we do that is that we just get the Klein-Gordon equation and the equation that expresses the canonically conjugate momentum in terms of the time derivative and other stuff of the field. We don't really have to go through this. Don't really have to prove that because we know that already from the general properties of the Legendre transform. That the equations of motion that we get on the Hamiltonian side must be equivalent to the equations of motion on the Lagrangian side. And the equations of motion on the Lagrangian side are these. This one was the Klein-Gordon equation, and that was the defining equation of the Legendre transform. So we are guaranteed that we get this out of those two equations over there. So we have equation of motion 1 and equation of motion 2. So how do we solve those three sets of equations? The canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity condition, and the equations of motion. The strategy is to try a clever ansatz. Some initial guess which already ensures that some of those conditions are fulfilled right away. It turns out that that's not too hard. And secondly, we will try to solve that problem by disentangling the condition to solve the canonical commutation relations from the condition to solve the equations of motion. It seems a little hard to do both at once. To solve the dynamical equations of motion, which are going to be really complicated, because if the space-time is really, you know, has no particular symmetries, it's just evolving in a complicated way, then the solution to the equations of motion must be expected to be complicated as well. And on the other hand, we have the canonical commutation relations to obey, which is something to do with non-commutativity. Trying to solve the two things at once seems a little hard, and they seem to be completely unrelated from each other. Here dynamics, there kinematics. And it turns out we can choose an ansatz which allows us to solve those two problems separately. We can solve the equations of motion without having ever to worry about non-commutativity. We can solve the non-commutativity constraints, the non-commutativity conditions, without having to worry about evolution and time evolution and equations of motion. So what is this magical ansatz with which we can solve, by construction, solve some conditions, like the hermeticity condition, and separate the commutation relation from the equation of motion, the kinematics from the dynamics? So here's this ansatz. The ansatz is that the field, or an ansatz means we try out whether that works, right? So let us try out whether it works, that we can write down the field phi of x and t as a linear combination, as a sum of terms of this form, where the ak and the ak daggers, we choose to be AK and AK daggers that obey the usual commutation relations. We know a lot about those guys. We know how to build a Fock basis out of them. We know how they act on that Fock basis. Therefore, we can think of them as being explicit given matrices. But if you don't want to write them as matrices, you just remember how you can define a Fock basis for each one of those pairs A and A dagger. These guys are supposed to take care of the non-commutativity of the canonical commutation relation. And then, but you see, they don't have a space or time dependence here at all. No time dependence, that's the key thing. No time dependence in those guys. Their job in this ansatz is only to make sure that we get the canonical commutation relations right. And then we multiply with an as yet completely unknown function, and we still have to determine uk of x and t, and its Hermitian conjugate, complex conjugate. So these are just regular number valued functions here, this and its complex conjugate. And since they are number valued, they cannot help us with canonical commutation relations. Their job is to obey the canonical the equations of motion. And then the canonical momentum field to phi, we simply define to be this. Now that's a clever definition, because if we define the pi to be this, then we already have taken care of one equation of motion. Right? It's got to be that relationship. Okay, so I mean earlier we just said that pi is phi dot, but now we say that pi is this, right? This is the generalization of phi dot that comes out of the Legendre transform. So this is by construction what it has to be. But that is not clear that this is going to help us. It's not clear that phi can really be written in this way. But one thing is clear, namely that if we succeed with this, one thing is clear that this succeeds with one thing at least. The hermeticity condition is already obeyed, just by the way of writing it, by the construction. Because check what happens if we take the Hermitian conjugate of phi. Well, if we take the Hermitian conjugate of phi, then let's take the Hermitian conjugate of the first term here. Now this term will go into its complex conjugate, and that term will go into a dagger. Okay. This term will become u, okay, and that term will become a, okay. So clearly, this becomes that, and that term becomes this term under Hermitian conjugation. Therefore, the whole thing automatically is self-adjoint for every x and t. Therefore, the hermeticity conditions are fulfilled right away. And then if this thing is self-adjoint, then applying those real-valued functions and the differentiation and so on, this thing is also self-adjoint. So that's fine. Now let's check for the kinematics and the dynamics. We have to check whether the commutation relations can be fulfilled and whether the Klein-Gordon equation can be fulfilled. So we said already all of this. So here's the first equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation. And we can make this hold. This equation of motion, we can guarantee to hold with our ansatz by doing the following. Sorry that I have to scroll so much. We can make phi obey the Klein-Gordon equation simply by making sure that the functions uk of x and t, each of them, for each choice of k, by making sure that for each k, these functions individually obey the Klein-Gordon equation. And that's because these guys don't have a space or time dependence. As far as the differential equation is concerned, these things might as well be 7 or 100. It's just constants, right? You can think of them as constant matrices. So if we choose the uk each to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then by the way, the complex conjugate of it will also be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, because the Klein-Gordon equation has only real coefficients. So if we choose this uk to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then the whole thing is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Because, remember, the Klein-Gordon equation looks like this. It's just a bunch of differential operators and multiplications and so on. So, as I said, the Klein-Gordon equation holds because if in our ansatz we write, if in our ansatz these guys solve the Klein-Gordon equation, then we can simply pull this in front of that entire operator. Because this has, you see, this has no matrix indices with respect to what this will be. I mean, this will be matrices eventually, or operators. And that is scalar as far as those operators are concerned. Okay, so that's the first equation of motion. The second equation of motion that we already talked about holds automatically because the equation for pi is by definition. So now we still have to check the kinematics, the Klein-Gordon equation. This is where it gets a little bit complicated. But you should expect that because now we are going, everything we did before was classical. Now we are making it quantum. You see, we have plenty of freedom here. So far, we only specified that those guys obey the commutation relations a dagger equal to Kronecker of k and k prime. Right? And we specified that these individually are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. But there is still a tremendous freedom in which solutions we choose. And the question is, can we use that freedom to choose solutions here such that that whole thing here obeys the canonical commutation relations? We could try it a cheap way. We could try to just take one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation and take its complex conjugate and then hope for the best that if we then calculate what the pi is and then calculate the commutator between phi and pi, we just happen to get that the commutator is IH bar Dirac delta of x minus x prime. Let's see. But we just have to accept the possibility that it will not be so easy. Maybe we'll need some complicated linear combination of those guys, something like that. Maybe we'll need more than just one solution here. Maybe we will even need to use a whole basis of solutions. We can have, look at the Klein-Gordon equation will have lots of solutions. And we can look at the space of solutions. And maybe what we need is a whole basis of those solutions. In fact, that's what it will eventually basically boil down to. Remember that when you take a basis in a Hilbert space, you can use it to write down a resolution of the identity in the Hilbert space. We will eventually need something like a resolution of the identity because what we want, the last remaining piece in the puzzle of solving the differential equation is to get the canonical commutation relations between phi and pi right. And the canonical commutator between phi and pi is on the right-hand side the Dirac delta. The Dirac delta is a resolution of the identity. And if you integrate it over, you get the same, Dirac delta of x minus x prime, integrate over x prime, you get the same function again. So really, ultimately, we should expect that something like that will come out. It's just a little more complicated than what I just indicated, but it's the direction in which it goes. Okay, so the question is, what condition do we need on the UK, and can it be fulfilled such that the phi and the pi that we get will obey the canonical commutation relations? And is it unique? Is there just one choice of UKs such that we solve the differential, so such that we solve the quantum field theory, or maybe there are several. Okay, so we have to check the canonical commutation relation. We have to check whether we can, with our ansatz, achieve by suitable choice of those solutions UK of the number valued Klein-Gordon equation that these commutation relations are fulfilled. Okay, let's just plug this stuff in there. We express phi in terms of our ansatz, where this is a number-valued solution of the, well, each of those is a number-valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. And we also express the canonically conjugate momentum field in terms of phi. And then we just plug those two expressions into that condition up there. So remember, if phi is this, then pi is this subbed into that, which gives us all of this. Right, you see how that goes? We carry that forward, and then we have that phi over here is spelled out over there, where we have put that derivative right in front of those functions. Okay, so you see how this is going. The commutator between phi and pi is going to turn out to be the commutator between this business and all of that, where the fact that the A and the A dagger don't commute with the A and A daggers of that will pick out certain terms. So the commutator is given by phi, comma, and this is pi. It's a pity that the screen is not big enough that you can see the whole thing at once. Okay, so we can pull these factors here in front. We have a double sum over k prime and k over here. And we have functions u and u star, u and u star, and we have derivatives of u and derivatives of u star over there. So we have terms with u, derivative of u star, and u star, derivatives of u. They are coming out this way, only those terms survive because we get only contributions when we have the commutator between an A and an A dagger, or between an A dagger and an A. So for example, the A dagger term over here gives us a U and a derivative of U star. That's this one, the U and a derivative U star. And then also this thing doesn't commute with that. That gives us a U star and a derivative of U with a minus sign because now we have A dagger and A. The commutator between A dagger and A is minus the commutator of A with A dagger. All of those commutators make the A and A daggers go away, and they get replaced with just the Kronecker delta, the right-hand side of, which is the right-hand side of the commutation relations between the A and A dagger. So now we see that we end up with just a single sum. This is a double sum, but we have a Kronecker delta over here. So we get this carried forward, and then a single sum is what's left over here, and these terms just carried forward. What we need is that the commutator between phi and pi is I times Dirac delta of x minus x prime. If we can achieve that, we're done. We've solved the differential equation. We've solved the quantum field theory. Assuming, of course, that we can find solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, classical ones, I mean number-valued ones, the U's, right? So for all of this to work out, this needs to be that. Is it? What about this? Looks a little tough here. What we could try is take, for example, as I discussed earlier, we could try it on the cheap. We could say, all right, we have a sum of OK, but maybe we get away with just one. Are we sure we have to make actually a sum over many solutions? What if we just take one term K? So if in our ansatz, we simply say, you know, this was the ansatz for trying to solve our quantum field theory. And we allowed ourselves lots of terms, summing over K. But maybe the ansatz succeeds, but not summing over K, but just taking one solution, one number-valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, and then cooking up this expression here. We are going to solve the hermeticity condition by doing that, and we are going to solve the Klein-Gordon equation by doing that, because this is assumed to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, so therefore that is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. The only thing we have to check is whether we get the canonical commutation relations right. So let's try that. Let's just say we don't sum. It's just only one term in here. And then go down to our equation and see what must hold then. Well, if we sum over only over one term here, then we must have that the u needs to be chosen to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which, when multiplied with its derivative with respect to space, and then you take minus the complex conjugate here, then we must get that this is I times the Dirac delta. Not possible. Not possible, because if this is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and its space derivative is here, complex conjugate of it, how is that product ever going to be a Dirac delta distribution? It's not going to be. Because any solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, hopefully, is not a Dirac delta or a square root of a Dirac delta, but is something nice, some wave. Okay, it's got to be a generalization of a plane wave in some sense, because we know that the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation on Minkowski space are plane waves, and the product of two plane waves is not a Dirac delta function. So clearly, we will not get away with simply trying an answer to where we are not summing over, where we just take one term. So clearly, we have to sum over lots of solutions if we are to succeed at all. In fact, infinitely many, because if we just take finitely many smooth solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, which are all smooth, because its coefficients are assumed smooth. If we take just finitely many of them, then well, the sum of finitely many smooth functions is still a smooth function. We're not going to get a distribution this way. We're going to need a complete set of functions in some sense, so that their sum adds up to a Dirac delta distribution. It's not clear that this is going to succeed, right? On the other hand, we do know that this ansatz has worked at least once before, this one. Because we did that ansatz also for Minkowski space earlier. And remember what we did then? We put our quantum field theory in a box. And then we had this ansatz where these were plane waves, where this was e to the power of ikx minus omega t. And we summed over all momenta k in the box. All the standing wave momenta in a box, and all of them. And yes, you can get a Dirac delta from summing infinitely many plane waves. Right? That's what the Fourier transform does. So in Minkowski space, this works out. Let's see whether this always works out, even when the space is curved. So, okay, remember, this is what we had to fulfill. That's the last remaining step. If we can solve that thing, then we are done, and the quantum field theory is solved. So the conclusion so far is this. We make that ansatz for the field, and it solves the quantum field theory. It solves the hermeticity condition, the equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relations. If we can find a set of number-valued solutions, un of x and t, of the Klein-Gordon equation, such that this ugly condition here is fulfilled. Without that condition, we are only getting the Klein-Gordon equation and the hermeticity condition. With that condition, we also get the canonical commutation relations. So when does such a set of solutions exist? When does our answer succeed? It turns out pretty generally. Not completely always, but pretty generally. So here's a proposition. Assume that space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic. So obviously, we have to go a little bit into theory here. So assume space-time is globally hyperbolic, which means that it is topologically of the form of the real axis, a real line axis for time, and then some manifold for space, some three-dimensional differentiable manifold. In this case, you cannot travel back into the past. There are no closed time-like curves. Another way to put it is that there are space-like hypersurfaces on which you can pose initial conditions, and they will determine what happens everywhere in the future. So-called Cauchy surfaces, where you can put initial conditions. So the proposition is that when space-time is globally hyperbolic, so no space travel into the past, then yes, it is guaranteed that there is such a set of functions, such a set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, which obeys this wild condition over there. And in fact, there's not just one such set, but there are many, many such sets. And it turns out that the relationship between this choice, it is just preview. You can't really fully understand from what I told you yet how that comes about, but I just want to give you a preview, a flavor of what's coming up. It turns out that the ambiguity in this or that choice of solutions gives us different ways of writing the solution of the quantum field theory. It will still always be the same solution to the quantum field theory, just in different bases, whether we choose this set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation or that set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. You get the same solution to the quantum field theory, just in different bases. And those two bases for a pair of sets of solutions will be related by Bogoliubov transforms. Remember, that was the kind of transform between the in states and the out states of a driven harmonic oscillator. So this is how that will resurface here in the quantum field theory. Now, the thing is that in principle, I wanted to go through the proof of this because it shows some non-trivial stuff, the so-called Dabu theorem that tells you about the diagonalizability of symplectic forms and how, therefore, this all comes about, that indeed there always is a set of solutions that allows you to write, to linearly combine the Dirac delta there. It's related to the spectral theorem, but it's not exactly the spectral theorem for self-adjoint operators. But on the other hand, it's pretty technical, and I think we've probably exhausted our energies quite a bit. So I thought I'd leave that to you to read that proof on your own time. It's quite a few pages, actually. It's like 8 pages of proving things. Pretty technical, and we won't need the details later on, but it's important stuff. So I suggest that you go through that on your own. Use it as assigned reading. Okay, so shall we wrap it up for today then?